Greetings and salutations from the Agile Revolution. This is Tony.
And Greg.
And we are very blessed today to have the wonderful Dave Thomas,
The original, the one who
founded Wendy's hamburgers.
Yeah, that's the one.
The one who signed the manifesto.
Welcome along, Dave.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So we're at 2015 in Brisbane, and you're here giving a couple of talks, which is awesome to have you out here.
It's my pleasure because I love being in Australia. So this has been a fantastic opportunity because I'm hitting three favorite cities, you know, which is actually two favorite cities and a brand new one. I haven't been to Brisbane before, so
there you go. Welcome.
Really enjoying it.
We're looking out the window. You're not, you're facing towards us, but the sun's shining. There's not a cloud in the sky.
Yes. Welcome to the little big country town, as we like to call it.
I like the feel of it, I have to say.
Yeah. So I was blessed to have been the track host here at Yale for your talk, and it was a pleasure indeed. And Agile's dead.
Agile indeed is dead. Agile is dead, and it's kind of
That's it. Thanks for coming.
We have to rename the podcast. Even, huh?
You do. No, I mean, the thing about Agile, maybe saying it's dead is kind of like a little bit, you know, too much. Agile has become, as a word, it's become meaningless because it's been co-opted by a whole bunch of people who don't really understand what agility is all about. And they go out there and they will sell a particular method or a particular set of practices or a particular book or a particular whatever, and say to a team, you know, who are honestly trying to do their best, right? And then these guys come along and say, okay, you're not agile enough. You need to do this, 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 and this. Right? And the reality of that is absolutely the opposite of an agile approach, because agility is always going to look at feedback. It's always going to be contextual. So it's always going to be based on what a particular team is doing at a particular time and a particular set of circumstances. And there are no canned solutions that you can use for those people. So if you come along and say, you know, the answer is Scrum or the answer is Kanban or whatever it might be, no, it's not. It never is and never will be. Instead, what people have to do is to go back to the origins and say, what was, you know, the manifesto for agile software development all about? And fundamentally, it just comes down to four values. And if you look at those four values, they're largely to do with feedback. You know, how do you operate something in such a way that you know you're going in roughly the right direction? And the smaller you can make the little cycle over which you get the feedback, the less rework you have to do if you discover it's gone wrong. So my point to the folks today was simply, when you do something, right, forget about following these off-the-shelf processes, but instead just always look for where I am now, what I have to do to make a small change to go forward, and then after I've done that change, how am I looking now? You know, and then apply whatever correction is necessary, and then go back and repeat. And if you do that, then you don't have to worry about all of these complex things that people bring in. Now, what you're doing instead is you're taking on a lot of the work yourself. You are going to have to migrate and manage your own processes through this period of transition. But the reality is you always had to, right? It's just they kind of fooled you into thinking you didn't. You know, so it's like that old story of stone soup, you know, where the soldiers went to a village and they were hungry. And they said to the villagers, you know, could you lend us a pot and some water? All right. And so the villagers said, well, yeah, we can do that. So they brought out a pot, water, put it on the fire. The soldiers took two stones out of their pockets, right, put it in the water and sat back. And the villagers said, is that it? And the soldiers said, yep, absolutely, that's it. That's all we need. And half an hour later, yeah, are you sure that's it? That's your soup? Yeah, that's the soup. Of course, it tastes a bit better if you put some potatoes in it, but you don't need to. So one of the villagers runs away and gets some potatoes, and they put the potatoes in the soup. And then, you know, 20 minutes goes by. Is that it? Yeah, absolutely, that's it. I mean, sometimes people put carrots in, but that's all. And so people ran away and put carrots in, and that's kept on going. You know, they put some lamb in, and they put some onions in, and after a while, they had this absolutely glorious stew. So the soldiers fished the two rocks out and then ate the stew, right? And that's kind of like what we're doing with a lot of the agile consultancies, in that we're kind of like going in there and saying, this is all you need to do. But the reality is the companies are actually having to do all the work anyway. So why don't we just recognize that and let them get on with it? Now, I'm not saying there's not a place for something like a Scrum or whatever else. I think it's a good starting point. And in particular, I quite like recommending Scrum to companies because I think it's simple and it's easy to see the results quickly. But it's not what you should be doing. It's what you should start doing. And then at the end of your first month or whatever it is you've chosen, now you're going to sit there and say, okay, what worked, what didn't work? The cool thing then is once you've got yourself up to a position where you've gone through that maybe 6 months, six cycles, and you've applied the feedback and you've adjusted the process accordingly, and you're sitting back thinking, hey, we did a really good job, everything's fine, no need to do anything, right? That's the point that you're about to fail. And at that point, what you have to start doing is taking away the things that you think you have to do. Yeah. So, for example, you may be doing a daily stand-up. So you'll say, okay, this month we're going to try without, see what happens. Or you may have certain rules about test coverage. So this month we're not going to do that. And see what impact that has on your process. Because it's really easy to adjust the obvious things and then forget about all of the inherent things, the innate things in a process. And really your job is to challenge both. And quite often you're surprised. You know, things that look like they are, you have to be doing these, they're totally mandatory, quite often they're irrelevant in your particular circumstances. So throw them away.
I think it's something we've been banging on here at the Agile Podcast for quite some time. So it was interesting as I was in the talk, the use of the word Agile. In fact, my good friend here has been banging on the fact that we should just rename it Raccoon.
Yes, absolutely.
So...
You with me on that?
Well, except Raccoon isn't... Again, it comes back to the problem that Raccoon is a noun, right? Which means you can go to the market and buy a pound of Raccoon. Right? And what I want to do is to move away from a noun, right? Agile is not a noun, but people are using it as a noun. And as a result, you can go out and buy it.
Well, that's what I want to call a raccoon.
Doesn't matter
what we call it.
There you go. All right, You could be a raccoon consultant. Right?
A raccoon consultant, I can see you.
There you go.
With a hat.
Endorsed by Dave Thomas. There you go.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah. The other thing, it's been my hobby horse, and sometimes I get a bit of stick for it, but it's the pieces like SAFe and so on, and particularly SAFe. Got a little bit of my ire there for a while.
Little bit of your ire.
All right. Maybe I understated that. But my problem with it is exactly, and I think you can, in something I couldn't verbalise today, which is, it is exactly that, is that they're telling everybody this is the solution and you must do, you're not agile because you haven't done .3 of the book that says you've got to do it in the 7th chapter and you must follow this formula or you're not agile.
Right, right.
Which really sticks in my craw, because the whole reason people like Craig and I got into this whole thing was because we knew that it wasn't working the way we were doing it and we needed something that worked better.
Exactly.
And we tried something and we stuffed up a fair few times before we got it right, or even half right.
Yeah.
I saw some of your code.
No. Last week.
No, that was a learning experience. That was an opportunity.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think the thing about these large, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I agree 100% that whenever you have a large framework like that, then really it's not flexible. It's not designed to be flexible. It's designed to be prescriptive because that's what people want. Okay, so then you got to ask yourself, okay, so what organizations are going to go for that? And these are the organizations that want to have a rule book that says this is how we do projects. And almost by definition, that's not going to be an agile organization. And by definition, that's not going to be a set of agile practices. So although SAFe, to be honest with you, I have no direct project experience with it. So I can't tell you if it works or doesn't work. I hear people say it does. And that's great. Good power, power to him. But I don't think it's an agile set of practices. So then the issue is, okay, so what do you do if you have a large organization, 1,000 developers or whatever, and you need to try to find some way to run that, and you are convinced that agility is the way forward? And the answer is, I think you have to accept that 1,000 people working in as one thing can never be agile. People say, how do you scale agility? And a whole bunch of people have answers for that. I think the reality is, it is almost impossible because the lines of communication get way too complex. And it's just, you spend more time trying to sync everything up than you do actually getting work done. So the alternative is to say, can you actually run an agile project in a non-agile organization? And the answer to that is no, right? Because an agile project needs to be able to change things like the boundaries, the times, or the deliverables, or whatever else. A non-agile organization is not going to put up with that. So really the answer is, how do you make an enterprise level agile? Is you actually make the enterprise itself agile first, and then the software follows along from that. And how do you make an enterprise, you know, into a, from a monolith into something more agile? You have to split it. You have to, maybe not like legally, you know, into separate companies or anything, but you need to take it into way more focused little chunks of independent operation. Right? Personally, I've never managed a multi-billion dollar company, but I can't help imagining that would be easier to manage. All right. It's not looking at like a conglomerate. It's not that kind of level. It's way deeper than that. It's independent people who you trust to make good decisions. Right? And if you do that, then you could call it a business team or whatever you want to call it. Each can have its own little software development chunk as well. And that could be a small group of people. And they could operate in an agile fashion. And they all come together in an agile fashion.
We've all heard the stories about how the manifesto for agile software development, which I'm retraining myself to say now. I've just been lazy. How that all came together, and I'm sure there's lots of stories on that. How do you feel like on that now, where we're, you know, almost 15 years down the track? Is it still something that you're incredibly proud of, and something that actually you think still holds up? Because there is lots of criticism in the community where people say we need to rewrite the manifesto, and that really gets my ire up, because I think it holds perfectly well 15 years on. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I am proud of it. Not so much the practices section, but the values section, I think is a nice way of trying to capture what we believe, you know? So I'm proud of that. In retrospect, I am not proud of the lack of diversity in the group of people that did it. I mean, we're basically a group of middle-aged white guys. That wasn't in any way deliberate. It just happened to be that was the group of people at the conference who happened to be talking about it, and then said, hey, let's go have a meeting somewhere. Probably, if we had realized that something like this was going to come out of it, I suspect we would have spent a bit of time after that event inviting other people. As it was kind of like herding cats anyway. So we just said, okay, let's everybody who's here come along, kind of thing. And we certainly had no expectation that we're going to generate something that became significant. The diversity issue, I think it's a serious one. I don't know how much it would have changed. But I think it would have been nice to have had the opportunity to change it. Does it need updating? I don't know. I don't think so. But maybe it does. I mean, the thing about it is the original manifesto was there as a reaction to the problems that people were having in development. I think it's fair to say that it has helped over the years. But people are still having problems with development. So maybe something new is required. Now, I think it would be a tragic mistake to try and produce Agile Manifesto 2, you know, because that happened to work. It captured the mood of the time, and it kind of caught on just the ways things do. You know, sometimes things catch, some things don't. If you just tried to reproduce it, it would just be a flop. I'm pretty much guaranteed of that. So instead, what you want to do is to think, okay, so what's more relevant today? You know, how can I express better, you know, my frustrations with the way software is developed? And, you know, I have no idea. It would be up to some group of clever people somewhere to come up with. And I would totally, if I believed in what they came up with, I would totally endorse it.
My view's always been on this, and, you know, interested for your feedback on this, is that quite often as I go out and, you know, send people on their journey down this path, they say to me, well, what's next? Yeah, that's always the thing, like, what's new and shiny? And the thing that I've always loved about it is, in the principles, the last one there is continuous improvement. And the beautiful thing about the Agile community is the Agile that I learned when I first did XP in 2002 to the Scrum that I started playing with in 2000, well, it's more of an XP Scrum hybrid in 2007, to now the Kanban flow, I'm not even sure what I call it, type process I do in 2014, 2015, has evolved. And that's because the community has been able to evolve around this word, Agile, but be able to take these things in different directions. And so I think the thing that I really appreciated about it is you built that continuous improvement in there, which is at the heart of not only when you develop software, but at the heart of the software development process itself.
I think it's bigger than that even. I don't think, to me, as I said, the practices aren't as important as the values, but the values kind of capture the continuous improvement anyway. If you view it as being, constantly look for feedback, right? And constantly be taking these small steps, then as an individual, forget about software development, forget about all the rest, right? As an individual, what do you do as you go through life? Well, I think you should be taking a small step away from the equilibrium point all the time and seeing, I didn't like that. Oh yeah, that was kind of cool. And just doing that over and over again, and you'll get to try new things, get to experience new things, and if they don't work, you'll know why they don't work. It's not just, sort of like a kid that says, oh, I don't like green food, It's more like you've actually tried it, and you said, no, it didn't work for me because this, this, and this, So as human beings, I think we owe it to ourselves in our limited lives to explore and to experiment and to get feedback based on that. So as a quote agile community, then I think what we're doing is just that. We're just like exploring new things, and we pick up the things that work, we drop the things that don't. The problem though is that things like Kanban and Scrum and everything else end up being like packages. So you buy the book How to Do Kanban or How to Do This and the Other, and they don't really capture the spirit of this is just the first step in a journey of something else, and I'd like to try to see more emphasis on the when you finish with this book, rip it up and go and do it yourself. Lots of great ideas out there, lots of fantastic things to try, but it's up to every team to try, and to try in a controlled way, in an incremented, like I say, lots of small steps, and see what works, what doesn't.
Yeah, it was interesting talking to Don Ronitson yesterday, and that sort of reflects him as well, was saying that, take it in these little small chunks and try the small pieces.
Absolutely.
And it still flies, no matter what. So the other interesting thing for me is that, I know you said the software piece should be there, but it has jumped the shark. When you work in companies like I do, for example, I see all of the knowledge work and the marketing and the HR, and they're all doing it. Mm. And they're all using the same software type mentality, and they don't even realize it once they get their hands around it because it works.
Right. And I think that's absolutely true. It's really a fundamental way of thinking about doing stuff. I couldn't agree more. Which is kind of why it's important to make sure people understand why they're doing it, right? Because otherwise it could be just like every other management fad. It's like, even down to things like org charts and stuff like that. Why are we doing it? Why did we do that? The same thing here. Why do we have this stand-up meeting every day? What a pain in the ass this is every day to come out and stand up in a circle, right? What are we trying to achieve? Why are we doing it? What's the value, and I think the challenge is, in software, most people at least have the opportunity to find out what those values are because they know the origin story. In accounting, that may not be the case. This might just be something that's dropped on them. And so somebody somewhere needs to be making sure that that picture is completed and people know why they're doing what they're doing in a bigger world.
The other thing, moving away from the Agile thing for a moment, and I mentioned to you this last week, is the Pragmatic Programmer. It'd be remiss of me not to mention that. That was a book that when I first read it, was handed to me right about the start of my journey. I read Kent books, Extreme Programming Explained, and I read The Pragmatic Programmer, and just for a while, I'll get you on the podcast. I want to thank you for that book.
Oh, that's really kind of you.
Because it's not only, I think, didn't only change my life as a programmer, but it's something now that I recommend to any graduate that that works in there. What was the impetus for writing that? Was what made you and Andy Carruthers put pen to paper?
So at the time, Andy and I were doing a fair amount of consultancy into teams with troubles. So we'd go into a team, I mean, one classic example is we went into a team where they had something like 15 developers, each had their own machine. No two developers could actually create copies of the software that were the same, right? So every developer's development machine was different. And who's got put into production was just basically a question of who happened to be the last person to compile, right? So, you know, that kind of thing. Teams that were deploying stuff with total, you know, zero version control or zero testing or anything else. So we kind of got a little bit, well, it wasn't exciting going in and saying the same things over and over and over again. So we thought, we'll put some web pages together or something that will describe like the basic things that we believe. And the way, because we're software people, it got totally out of hand. And we got to about 100 pages. And I actually used my wife, who said, if you give this away, you're crazy. You know, you need to create a book or something. So we hadn't the faintest idea what it meant to write a book. So we came up with a master plan, and that was we were going to submit what we had to Addison Wesley, who we thought at the time were the best technical publisher in our area. And they'd reject it. But when they rejected it, they'd tell us why, and that way we'd be able to fix the book up and then send it to some other publisher. And they totally screwed with us by actually accepting the book. Basically, at that point, we were on the hook to get a book out, which we did. It took a lot longer than we thought, and it involved quite a lot of, should we say, discussion about trying to hone down the things we believed. That was a big surprise, because really it was supposed to be a set of field notes, and I don't know. Again, it kind of like caught the times or something. I don't know.
And it still sells well now today, you're saying?
It's amazing. It really does. And a lot of it is quite dated. Not the advice isn't, but the examples are, you know. And it's surprising that despite that, it's maybe people are reading it and laughing. I don't know. But, it's still a very popular book, which is fine.
I think it goes back to what you're saying before, though. I think it goes back to the fact that it's got the basics.
Yeah.
And the things that you elicit in there, even though your examples may be dated, the actual basics that you elicit in there that programmers should be thinking about and should be doing to create quality software,
right,
still fly.
I think so. And, I mean, there are some things that we invented. Nothing conceptually that we invented. But we, like, you know, we pushed things like dry, which seems, it's really staggering to me that that's become like just a universal buzzword. I can't believe that, because that was just like an off-the-cuff acronym to, like, you know, oh, let's call it dry. There's nothing new in that book. It's just really an expression of stuff that the people we respected were doing, you know?
Mm. And as a result, it's infected teams worldwide, and or more particularly individuals worldwide.
Yeah, I hope so. Mm. I hope so. That was just kind of cool.
Yeah. So then how did the whole publishing bit come along then? Is it because you describe yourself as an accidental publisher?
Oh, well done. Yes, we do. The publishing thing came about because, let's think. So we wrote the Programmatic Programmer and then launched directly into the Ruby book. So we got to the end of the Ruby book, and it had been something like 3 years writing books. And for the majority of that time, we were not billing. And so we were down to eating our shoes and our children. So we needed to get back to consulting. Added to which, I mean, when you get out of it for a while, you kind of forget what's going on, and you lose touch with the stuff. So we went back into consulting at the end of 2000, beginning of 2001, which was possibly the worst time on the planet to get back into software consulting, because it was just everything basically died. So we did about a year's worth of consulting, and we felt we needed to find like another string to the bow. And so we thought about writing a set of three books on the basics of projects. So that would be automation, testing, and version control. And so we were on the point of contacting Addison Wesley about this, and we got to thinking that, well, for the Programmatic Programmer and the Ruby book, we did all of the typesetting, all of the layout, all of the indexing, everything. So really what they did was they printed it and marketed it. So we thought to ourselves, we used the classic words that basically, you know, everyone should shoot themselves the second they utter them. We said, how hard could this be? So we started, we wrote the version control book and the testing book and published it ourselves. We found a printer down in Florida that would print it for us. And every now and then a truck would arrive outside the house and would fill the garage with crates of books. And then Andy and I would ship them. We wanted to get the automation book done. And Mike Clark, for some reason, wanted to write it. So at that point, we had an author. And then from then on, it just kind of snowballed. And all of the people that we knew said, oh, that looks cool. We want to join in with that. And so before we knew it, we had like half a dozen books. And then it just kind of grew from there. But the reality is, we know nothing about publishing, absolutely nothing. And I think that's been our biggest strength. Because a lot of publishers are caught up in the way that publishing traditionally has worked. I mean, the standard unit of information interchange in publishing is the spreadsheet. So nothing's automated. You know, it's all people sitting there entering numbers into spreadsheets. And with us, I mean, we took the publishing business for the first 3 or 4 years with no employees at all, because everything we could automate was automated, you know. And even now, we have two employees, and we have a lot of people that work with us, but just two employees, and that's because we don't do it the way the other people do it, you know. So that's been fun.
And I guess the strength is in the authors that you have in your program. So
it's the authors, but also, to be fair, it's the editors. Yeah. Because most publishers, the editor is largely to do with marketing. Our editors are typically writers themselves, English majors or whatever else. And we take them through a training period where we explain the structure and the voice of our books. So I don't know if you've noticed it, but all our books have most of the technical books have a very stylized structure. So you'll start off with an easy win project, and then you'll go back to the beginning and we'll explain why it worked. And at the very start of the book, you'll find that the author is very directive, do this, do that. By the end of the book, the author should be saying, we did this, we did that, or you did that. Because as you go through the book, you go from being a beginner, where the author's telling you what to do, to being more competent, and you and the author are a team, right? So we have that standard structure, and our editors are really, really good at helping our authors fit into that. And so they help them with the voice, they help them with, you know, focusing on what's important. We recently, as in about a year ago, started doing a kind of Hollywood thing where we ask authors to storyboard their books. And some of them do it graphically, some of them do it just in text. But the key point there is we want them to understand that there is an arc as you go through the book. And so each chapter gets a section on the storyboard, and you can make sure that there's a progression for the reader from the beginning to the end. The authors are fantastic. Don't get me wrong, they are absolutely amazing. And they are both good writers, but also really they know their technology.
And I think that was what I was alluding to, is that they're the people that, you know, I think lots of people in my field, you know, that I look up to, they're there writing a book
yeah.
like that.
So, yeah.
You know, not some name you kind of go, never heard of that person.
Yeah, I think that's important to us. We look for that definitive side. There's it's funny, we get proposals in, and a lot of them fall into the one-shot people. And we call those the what I did on my summer vacation books. Yeah. You know, I've written a framework, or, you know, I've written this or that, you know, I want to document it. And that's not what we're looking for. Mm. You know, we're looking for people that know how to apply stuff, you know, get stuff done. So, but enough about us, because that's kind of like a little bit of self-serving.
That's right. So speak to me about the Ruby community. So I was talking to someone earlier today, and they were saying, you know, they wonder where Ruby's going to end up, if it does have a future. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, definitely Ruby has a future. I think Ruby is a fantastic language, and I think the people doing Ruby are fantastic people. I think that for Ruby to so before Rails, so prior to whenever it was 2006 or whatever, Ruby was a community of people that you pretty much knew. I mean, there may be 4,000 or 5,000 people in it.
Very small.
It was small. And the mailing lists were unbelievably friendly, and everybody knew everybody else. And, you know, there were characters, and we all met together in the conferences and things. Post-Rails, it took off. I mean, even just look at our book sales. You know, they'd be going up really nicely. Then Rails goes, and it goes vertical for a while as everybody and their dog decides they want to be a Rails programmer because, let's face it, everybody and their dog wants to write a blog in 10 minutes, right?
And it was the book.
It was. Oh, absolutely. It was the book. Of course it was the book. So it took off. And I think for a while, people were on that roller coaster thinking it can only go up, you know? And now we're kind of plateauing, I think. I mean, more and more companies are using Rails, which is great. It's become acceptable to enterprises to use Rails, which is fantastic. But at the same time, I'm not seeing the level of innovation I was seeing early on. All right, I'm seeing a lot of tweaking, a lot of making this faster or better or whatever else. But one of the things about Rails is that successive releases are typically incompatible with the previous ones. And you went to that new release because it had all these fantastic new things that you just had to have, whether it was security or performance or whatever else. Now the drive to upgrade, to my mind, is a lot less. And once that happens, I think Rails has to start thinking very carefully about where it's going. So I think Rails, as I say, is going to plateau at some point. Now, the problem is that many people associate Ruby exclusively with Rails, you know? Ruby isn't Rails. Ruby was a very nice language before Rails came along, and it will continue to be a nice language if, you know, if Rails jumps the shark. So I think that Ruby has a future, but it needs to carve it out a little bit and to distinguish itself as a fantastic general-purpose programming language. The community in general is still unbelievably friendly, very supportive, very professional. A lot of the innovations and things like testing have come from that community, and I think they have a lot to offer. So, you know, I don't see Ruby. I don't see Ruby dying in anything like, you know, short or medium term.
You may note, I'm not sure whether you said it here, but you certainly said at the Melbourne conference that perhaps there's too much emphasis on testing, particularly in the Ruby community, because it's, you know, test everything.
You actually mentioned that today as well.
Yeah, I think so. I am whenever I come across people who say you must do this, right? I clearly had a really bad childhood or something, because I immediately respond, no, you know, I'm not going to do that. And the testing or the emphasis and dogma behind testing in, I don't know if it's the Ruby community or the Rails community. I come across it mostly in the Rails community, and so it's probably more on that side. It is really off-putting. People are kind of quite rude about, you know, if you don't test, you're an idiot. And people spend inordinate amounts of time working on tests, which frankly are nothing more than just a little bit of code masturbation. I mean, it's not really actually, you know, getting them any further forward. I went to a talk a few years back by somebody who was using RSpec. And as you know, in RSpec, you can write these matchers, which allows you to change the syntax of the test so you can say, you know, sort of, when I do this, then I expect whatever, right? So you can write a matcher that matches those phrases. And this person had actually spent like a month on their project metaprogramming a matcher generator so they could write new matches more easily. give me any rationale for that, right?
Well, I mean, like in Java, testing getters and setters. The point.
Yeah, exactly that. But it's worse than that, because here is someone who actually thinks it's more valuable to write something, to write a test. And no, it's not. Never was, never will be. And in particular, in that case, I mean, I find that the entire sort of, you know, Ars Specky kind of way of expressing things, it's cool, but why do I have to be so verbose, right? Why do I have to write cucumber tests that are like, you know, sort of like War and Peace, when I could just say assert A equals B? So, I am.
I think you hit the nail on the head there. Is the cucumber thing has been a very interesting. You know, if you talk to people like Goyko Adzik or Dan North, and really get into it, you know, it's that conversation when you're in a large organisation where you need people to understand what's going on, then go write cucumber tests. But if you're writing a small, if you're in a three-person development company, you know, you don't need that overhead of cucumber.
Right, except, okay, so the theory of cucumber, the way I understand it, and I'm very happy to be proved wrong, the theory of cucumber was that you could write tests in English,
Yes.
and they would be understandable by your business partners.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would be able to look at this and verify that your code was correct. Two problems with that. First of all, it's not English. It's code. And it reads like code. Mm. And I don't think they're any more capable of expressing, of understanding that just because you can put some lipstick on it, right? It makes it no different. It's still code. The second assumption is that the business people know what they want. And you know what? They don't, right? And the whole point of agility is you don't give them tests, you give them something that doesn't do what they want. And then they say, excuse me, that doesn't do what they want. And you go, that's what you asked me for. And they said, yeah, but that's not what I meant. And you go, oh, okay. And you go back and you deliver something else, right? Getting them to write, you know, or to agree to a whole bunch of cucumber tests gets back to a contract, right? You said this in the test, therefore that's what you're going to get. And it's an absolute violation of the values of the agile movement, you know? So, yeah, I'm not a big fan of cucumber. I think it's a cool piece of work, but I think it's way too much ceremony, and I don't think it achieves the benefits that people expect.
Well, we could talk to you for hours.
Yeah.
But,
we honestly could. Yeah.
But I guess just in closing, you know, I mean, we are an agile podcast, and yeah, I think, you know, and I speak for Tony here as well, that the Manifesto for Agile Software Development is something that we read very early on, signed very early on,
yes.
And the fact that we just get to stand here, we want to thank you
for
that work. You know, forget all the other stuff that's come after it. It's something I think that changed, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, Tony, but changed our lives in the way that we develop software. And our job now, and why we do this podcast, is hopefully to, you know, just keep other people thinking about, you know, reinventing and doing things differently and just getting stuff done, which was the whole reason why I came along to it. And the fact that you all got together and put something down there and inspired us to change is the thing.
But you know what? The reality of, I mean, that's really, really sweet of you to say. The reality is all we did is we got together for a couple of days and we wrote, you know, a couple hundred words. Right? And really, it's you that's actually made this live, right? It's because, I mean, I have put zero effort really into promoting agility until, you know, I'm now unpromoting it. but it's really, it's people like you that get out there and actually try to apply it, find the bumps, you know, try something different, fix it up. So really it's we should be thanking you and everybody else like you that's actually trying to put this into practice at the sharp end.
I think it gave us the permission in a time where perhaps we didn't feel like we had the
ability
to do it.
Yeah, I think that could be the case.
I put it down to some of the best working experiences of my life. You know, where I've worked with teams, like there's a particular team I quote all the time. I spent 2 years with them and we started the journey together and we improved, and, you know, it was a very sad time for me when I left that team,
right?
Because it was the most amazing experience of my 2 years, and it was that permission to try, fail, introspect, retrospect.
And communicate
as a group, you know, and we could do things together because we just knew each other. We just went bang, 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 bang.
Yeah.
It was fantastic.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us, Dave. If people want to know more about you, follow your rants and all the rest of it, where will they find you?
Prag Dave is me. I think we've got to close down here because they're shutting down the world around us. But just search for Prag Dave and you'll find my blog, you'll find me on Twitter, everywhere else.
So we've got one last thing when we end the podcast, where we want people to rise up against their organisations and do things differently. So we say, Viva la Revolution.
So please join us
on that. So
absolutely.
One, two, three.
Viva la Revolution.
Thank you.